Ladies and gentlemen, good morning. Welcome to our program on social factors in Cuba. My name is Peter DeShazo. I'm the director of the Americas program, and I'm delighted to be here with a very distinguished panel of experts who will be examining different factors, different issues, variables on the social conditions in Cuba today. To my right is Dr. Katrine Hansing, who is Associate Director of Cuban Research Institute at Florida International University, who will be our first speaker. And then Dr. Andy Gomez, the Assistant Provost, Senior Fellow, Institute for Cuban and Cuban-American Studies at the University of Miami. And then Dr. Juan Antonio Blanco, Researcher and Director of International Cooperation Citizen Digital Facilitation, coming from Ottawa, Canada. You have the bio data of the three speakers, so I won't go into detail. But let's begin our program and leave plenty of time for questions and answers. At the end, we'll begin with Dr. Hansing. Katrine?
Thank you. Well, first of all, let me thank CSIS and particularly Peter for inviting me to participate in this panel. Also, my two co-panelists and you, the audience, for coming here this morning. As the title of our panel suggests, Social Factors in Cuba, the aim of being here this morning is to kind of look at and examine what's happening in Cuban society at the grassroots level. I'm an anthropologist. I lived in Cuba for over half of my life, so I speak from that perspective as somebody who's done a lot of research there and somebody who lived there, and so part of this is also very much based on personal experience. To contribute and kind of jumpstart this conversation, what I thought I would do is basically talk about and outline some of the macro changes that have taken place in Cuban society in the last, 15 to 20 years since the beginning of the so-called special period. Many of you might not know that's the period that we refer to talk about the economic crisis in Cuba that started after the fall of the Soviet Union. And since then, the island has undergone some major socioeconomic and other changes and transformations, which have in turn brought about and produced new dynamics, spaces, and attitudes amongst Cubans, ordinary Cubans, at the grassroots level. And so those are the kinds of things I want to talk about today. And to just illustrate this, I'd like to just share a few, as we call in anthropology, vignettes with you of everyday life on the island to make this more visually interesting. So it's 9 a.m. and Dalia, a 20-year-old Afro-Cuban woman, is anxiously waiting for Carlos, a local street vendor, to pick up her freshly made croquetas. Croquetas, as some of you might know, are these little snacks that people eat. They're mainly made out of chicken or fish or sometimes even pork, and they're deep fried, and they kind of still your immediate hunger very quickly. And over the past few years, Dalia has stayed up every night making around 200 cheese, chicken, or fish croquetas, which Carlos then tries to sell to hungry Santiagueros during the day. Dalia is an accountant by training and until recently worked for a Cuban state-owned company. Although she liked her work, she could no longer survive on her meager income and had to leave her profession. "I had no choice," she says. "I only earned 280 pesos cubanos, in local currency, and could not feed my mother, daughter, and myself on that wage. I now make croquetas, but at least we can get by. 280 pesos cubanos are about 11 U.S. dollars. Similarly, for the past few years, Juan, an accomplished neurosurgeon who has served as a doctor on several internationalist missions to Africa, could no longer provide for his family of five on his monthly peso income as a doctor. Having earned the right to buy a car after his first mission to Zambia, Juan, like many other Cubans who are lucky enough to own a car, has become a taxi driver. Due to high costs and difficulties in acquiring a taxi license, Juan, however, works illegally. Despite the risk of a high fine if caught, he nevertheless drives his car around town every day and night looking for potential clients preferably foreigners who will pay in hard currency or convertible pesos. What can I do, he asked. We need to live. I don't like working illegally, but the state has literally pushed me into being dishonest. Now, as examples like these show, the economic crisis has not only altered people's lives in very practical, everyday kinds of ways, but also provoked major changes in people's attitudes and actions towards their own lives, their futures, and the state. Before the crisis, most Cubans relied on the government, and I call the crisis the economic crisis in the early 1990s. Before then, most Cubans relied on the government, and arguably, many still had faith in the system. The stagnating economy, eroding quality of health care, education, and other social services, coupled with the growing corruption and continuing repressive policies, have, however, led more and more people to no longer count on the state to help them solve their problems, but instead force them to look for alternatives. Although apathy, depression, and leaving the country for good are some of the more drastic and, for sure, dramatic measures people resort to, many, if not most, Cubans have been responding by creating and carving out their own spaces, networks, and mechanisms, whether economic, social, cultural, or other, independently or at least parallel to the state. Beyond the realm of the informal economy, we thus, for example, find that religious centers and communities, whether Catholic, Protestant, Pentecostal, Afro-Cuban, Jewish, or other, have turned into increasingly important alternative spaces where people seek spiritual refuge and meaning as much as they do entertainment, company, and material support, as well as access to the outside world. Similar conclusions can be made about the increasing interest in alternative subcultures, such as the rap or hip-hop, rock or rockero, techno, as well as Rastafari movements. Particularly attractive to Cuba's youth, who make up more than half of the island's current population and are arguably amongst the most frustrated, these alternative lifestyles offer some the possibility to question and explore who they are and what they want beyond the dominant political discourse. In fact, the search for news, information, and knowledge beyond that provided by the state has become an important endeavor for most Cubans. While contact with family members and friends abroad, as well as doctors and other professionals who have completed internationalist missions, like many of you probably know, many of the doctors are in Venezuela, but they're all over the world. They're in 80 different countries. Interacting with tourists and listening to Radio Martí are among the more established forms of doing so, i.e. getting alternative forms of information. But in addition to that, clandestine cable TV antennas, internet connections, and illegal video rentals have also become more common, particularly in Havana. Pedro, for instance, I know this, he used to be my neighbor. Pedro, for instance, is set up with what is locally referred to as un cable, a cable. For 5 convertible pesos, which is a little over 5 US dollars a month, he, like dozens of his neighbors in Central Havana, is connected to a cable TV antenna through which he gets to watch movies, news and sports programs, talk shows and telenovelas from Mexico, Miami, and elsewhere. Although highly illegal, more and more people are taking such risks in order to connect with the outside world and experience a completely different reality. These examples demonstrate how people are increasingly carving out alternative spaces and parallel mechanisms to the state. And in so doing, they are acting independently, taking initiatives but also responsibility for themselves, i.e. taking their own lives into their own hands, which after decades of depending on a cradle-to-grave system is a huge step, especially psychologically. Now, given that many of these activities and mechanisms involved doing so are deemed illegal by the state and often have major fines or other consequences, people have to be very creative in outwitting the system and must constantly be on their toes not to be caught. These are skills that can and should not be underestimated, let alone the energy and determination that go into them. Moreover, these activities are acts of defiance, defiance against a system that prohibits people from making an honest, decent living. And that takes courage. So in short, a qualitative difference in the way many people think and act has emerged and is growing more and more each day. It is this independent attitude and its accompanying actions that I would argue are among the most important social changes that have occurred on the island at the grassroots level in the last decade and a half, and they might just turn out to be one of the greatest challenges to the Cuban state. Now, a good example of this is three weeks ago, Cuban artist Tania Bruguera, which maybe some of you have heard of, staged a public performance during the Havana Biennale, biennial, in which she set up a podium with a microphone and had two actors dressed in the uniform of the Ministry of Interior. She asked people in the audience, and this was a lot of people, like 300 to 400 people, to come up, whoever wanted to come up to the podium and speak freely for 1 minute. As a result, the reaction was unbelievable. Dozens of Cubans took to the mic and protested, amongst other things, but predominantly the lack of freedom of expression on the island, called out for democracy, the freedom of political prisoners, etc. Now, there's been a lot of debate how to read this, but if anything, I think the spontaneous public reaction on the part of the public who were there shows that more and more people are slowly but surely losing their fear, although there's still a strong culture of fear among people in Cuba, but there's things happening that people are slowly shedding it to speak up at such an event in public. Now, I could end my comments on what I have to say today here, right there, on this fairly, I guess, upbeat and positive note of how things in Cuba are changing at the grassroots levels, attitudes and actions, and perhaps these are signs of what I call personal agency and a nascent civil society, which they no doubt are. But this is not the full picture. And unfortunately, there is a flip side to this story, which includes several of the more preoccupying effects and consequences of the crisis, economic crisis, on people's behavior, attitudes, and values, and thus my reflections continue on a more sobering note. As mentioned, the economic crisis and the many scarcities it has produced has forced people to seek alternative, usually informal and illegal means to resolve their problems, which basically means surviving, and which has also in turn encouraged corruption and criminality. Breaking the law has in fact become standard practice, as has the phenomenon of la doble moral, or doble cara, which broadly speaking refers to a dual set of behaviors and opinions, one for public, the other for private consumption, i.e. people think one thing, say another, and some people would argue even often feel another. So you have a very fragmented set of, you know, things going on. And in a society like Cuba, where state surveillance is omnipresent, la doble moral can be seen as a survival mechanism or an act of resistance, a weapon of the weak, as political scientist James Scott would call it. However, the level of hypocrisy, instrumentalism, manipulation, and opportunism towards the state, but also, and this is the preoccupying factor, amongst ordinary Cubans themselves, has taken on very worrying proportions. Although acknowledged by many, the phenomenon of la doble moral is not openly publicly confronted, but has instead become an unchecked modus operandi for many. In fact, many young people who were born and or socialized during the special period, i.e. during the last 10 to 15 years, have grown up in an environment in which thinking and acting in this manner has become normative behavior. This has had and continues to have an enormous impact on the social and ethical fabric and fiber of society. So in sum, we can thus on the one hand observe this newfound grassroots independence and a sense of personal agency kernels and seeds, perhaps, as I said before, of a nascent civil society. But on the other hand, we are confronted with an alarming growth of social disengagement and deterioration of civic values and engagement. And the question is, and it is one I'll leave you with today, and one we can definitely discuss in the Q&A session, is what impact these diverse and changing social dynamics and attitudes, and especially values, at the grassroots level will continue to have on the development of Cuban civil society, and in particular Cuba's youth, which, as I said before, makes up more than half of the population today on the island, and its role and engagement in the island's future. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Dr. Hansing. Dr. Gomez?
Thank you. I'm delighted to be with you and see some of my colleagues in the audience, too. Peter, thank you very much for the invitation. It's always a pleasure to leave Havana of the North, as I call Miami, where we live Cuba 24/7. And I think sometimes the days are actually longer than just 24 hours and spend a little bit of time. I'd like to build on what Catherine has set up so well for me to follow. But rather than tell you, I'd like to invite you to think with me. Because as I go through this, and I've been doing this now for a number of years, my theory has been that I think any of us can possibly change political governments or economic systems that have lived under totalitarian regimes before you can psychologically transform human behavior to support change. And I'm not even using the word democracy yet. I can tell you as I get older, as I'm sure some of you, I won't say all of you, some of you in the audience, the less change I like, not only at work, but at home. So I'd like to talk to you a little bit today about the psychological and social changes in Cuba after Castro. Castro 1 and Castro 2. Because I do believe that we're starting to see some of the psychological changes already taking place when Fidel became sick, Raul took over, and all of a sudden Raul announces this so-called, let's use the word, limited economic reforms, such as the use of cell phones, buying computers and whatever not. And then, you know, there were segments of the Cuban population, particularly Cuba's youth, that welcomed this very much. And then all of a sudden, July 26 comes around, and his speech just changes the entire thing. Let's talk about what Cuba's population looks like today. And it has declined a little bit. 11.2 million, 8 million born after 1959. This is it. They were born into the revolution. As a matter of fact, I was telling my colleagues, a friend just brought me a month ago from Cuba all the social study books that they use to, you can use the word, indoctrinate the ideology, and they are outstanding to a great extent on how well they are written. You begin to wonder whether Cuba history started in 1959 and anything before was somewhere else. 2.2 million born after 1992, the group that Catherine is talking about. This is the group that I think is the new opposition. It's an opposition that doesn't have a definition yet. It's an opposition among Cuba's youth that are beginning to somehow now contradict the values and attitudes that they have actually been brought up with to a great extent. But this is also the group that sees lack of hope and lack of future. And this is the group that most likely, once Fidel's out of the picture, if Raul doesn't address some of their needs, will likely be the first ones to leave, as we're beginning to see, too, already. The other day, I had the pleasure, like I do on a regular basis, to talk to a young man, 23 years old, that had arrived in Miami. And I asked him how things were going. He says, they're going fine. I said, what's attracted you the most or struck you the most? He says, I can't get up from sitting in front of a computer and reading and studying everything that has taken place. I said, fantastic. He turns to me and says, what happened to Yugoslavia? Think about that. What happened to Yugoslavia? So the lack of information, the lack of knowledge for a lot of these youth is a key question. The other point, I think, too, that is often forgotten is the 62% of the island, on the average, by Cuban statistics, is Afro-Cuban. And if you throw the self-identification of mulatto, that number can go as high as 72 to 75%. What I'm trying to tell you is you have a white Cuban exile community and a primarily Afro-Cuban community on the island, which is not necessarily in leadership positions, even within the Fuerzas Armadas Revolucionarias. When you take a look at the number of Afro-Cuban generals, they're absent to a great extent. And that not only is going to play a key role in the future, it plays a key role today. Because even now that the remittances are going back, from a majority to a minority. They're not going to the Afro-Cubans to a great extent. As many of you know, the Gallup poll was allowed in 2007 to go into Cuba for the first time, and they took a pretty good poll, pretty good temperature. And I just have here two figures for you that I like to share. 49% of the Cubans believe in the Cuban government, 49%. After 50 years and 8 million born into the Cuban Revolution, I would think that number would be much higher. So they're beginning, like Catherine Thing said, they're beginning to question the system in itself. They're beginning to look towards the future. More interesting, 26% of the Cubans said that they were unhappy with their personal freedoms. Of the 118 countries around the world that Gallup keeps statistics on, this is the lowest percentage when they ask the question of personal freedoms. This is the lowest. Now, it is not what Fidel, if he is having better days physically and mentally, or Raul, once Fidel's out of the picture, what kind of political system or what kind of economic system they're going to have. But the real challenge is how they're going to meet the human needs of the people on the island. Basic needs, and you see them up there, safety, food, housing, jobs, transportation, education, training, health care, followed by the higher level needs, freedom of speech, entrepreneurship, and then an open political system. If you talk to Cubans on the island today, as I do very, very often, sometimes even daily, and those that arrive, a lot of them could care less what political system. But they really want to see their own personal lives improve. No need to say what they've gone through, particularly after this past summer with the three hurricanes that went through and the damage that it's caused. But if that's the case, I have traveled to Cuba, and unfortunately I'm not allowed to return. Hopefully that will change very soon. But I've also traveled extensively through East and Central Europe, and I have found parallels in the two. And again, here I like to talk about and invite you to think with me, what are the psychological impacts of living in a totalitarian regime for 50 years? The distrust of the state and authority, the prison mentality that you live in, that lack of initiative, and then you abdicate your own personal responsibility to the state, distrust for others, and in some cases, your own family, your own relatives, living in the culture of fear, not knowing what tomorrow would bring if you say something that might be in disagreement with the government, the concept of, as you said, Catherine, of resolver. Getting up in the morning and worrying about putting food on the table for your family, your friends, and what that might actually take you, which breaks the very fortitude of moral values, attitudes, and ethics that you and I are used to. How do you recapture that to a great extent? Not overnight, and not by promising that democracy is going to resolve it. And last but not least, what I say that we Cubans suffer from, I'll include myself, lo informar. And when I say lo informar is, you know, I agree with you as long as you agree with me. The moment you disagree with me, then you're wrong and I'm right. You know it very well. So you get 12 Cubans in the room and you come up with 12 different opinions. But that has been through history to a great extent. You know, we were chit-chatting in Peter's office before we came down, and I told him, I said, I just gave my mother, who's in her elderly years, just to get her mind moving, so about this last book where she talks about her disbelief of what the Cuban Revolution came about. And Mab reminded me, she says, you know, after I finished reading Soy's book, I realized we lived in a fantasy Cuba, your father and I, as we were growing up. I mean, this thing stopped March 10th, 1952, when Batista stepped in and we didn't do anything about it. The absence of civil society in the foundations, even before Fidel came in. And these are things that cannot be built overnight, at least I think. So I've been developing this chart now for almost 10 years, the change process, as I call it. Where do we go from totalitarian control all the way to the preservation and maintenance of a democratic state? And I think before you can actually begin to talk about the establishment of democratic institutions, you have to have a transformation of human values and attitudes. But you cannot tell a Cuban that has been there for 50 years that this has been a bad dream. That tomorrow, here's the book. Or that we're going to go back to the 1940 Cuban Constitution and pick it up where we left off. Or, as we've seen in some of the East and Central European governments that have gone through this process, where the older generation has become nostalgic for the way that things were. Not that they were better, but they knew how to behave within the box. How do you break that box? And on the other hand, the youth actually break the box overnight and they want the system to move faster than it can actually give it to them. This process, I dare to say, could take a whole generation, if not more. Could take a whole generation, particularly if you look, as Juan Antonio and I were talking about, Cuba's history even before to where we are today. So, what's the equation for change? And, gee, I hate to do this to Fidel, but let me put Fidel out of the picture. People's expectations plus limited reform, economic reforms, I think it would be short-term regime survival. I have gone on record and say once Fidel is underground, I give Raul 6 months to a year to improve the social living conditions, particularly of Cuba's youth, or he's going to have some real social problems within the island. Or people's expectation, limited economic reforms and limited political reforms, which can be a real possibility, could be a long-term regime survival. And that's an equation that we keep playing with, and I'm not going to bore you with all the scenarios and variables that we keep playing with. But the key issue here is, how do you go from what I believe has been always Fidelismo before communism to Raulismo, which I do believe Raul is much closer to the ideological left than Fidel has ever been. can we go, even the Cuban people, within the nomenclatura itself, from Fidelismo to Raulismo? That remains a question we'll need to watch. Cuba Barometro in October 2nd actually did, I don't know if you guys saw it, the survey inside, and there's two things that I picked up here that I wanted to share with you. Down in Havana, 47% of the people that were surveyed did not agree with the measures that the new government had done to improve their basic needs. This is the Cuban government taking a poll of their own people. More importantly, 80% did not agree with the political changes being made by Raul Castro. I have to tell you, sitting in front of Telemundo nationally as they were going through this process, I was caught off guard when Raul named Machado Ventura to be the first vice president. As a matter of fact, some of us in Miami said we might have cost Carlos Laje his future because we all predicted that most likely it would be Carlos Laje. But this also shown how inflexible still the regime is to a great extent. Now, this is a map, and I serve, I hate to use the word consultant, but often meet with the folks at DOD and the Cuba Task Force in Florida out of Southcom. This is a map that we have developed of the possibility of the is no changes from a Raul Castro government, and then all of a sudden a mass exodus, which is a very strong possibility. Between the fall of 07 and all of 08, 77,000 Cubans arrived in South Florida. 28,553 arrived via Mexico through the Yucatan Peninsula. The United States Coast Guard covers 55,000 square miles, and at the most, we have four cutters out there. That's a hell of a big ocean. I just took a 10-day cruise, and I can tell you that's a hell of a big ocean. And the smuggling operation continues to increase. Continues to increase. So the possibility of us having to block the Florida Straits with 33 ships, three flat tops, picking up Cubans, what the hell do we do with them then? That's the question that remains. Then there's the Cuban-American community, which has changed dramatically. We have basically three different periods, and you see the numbers up there. The number that I told you before, 86% Caucasian. So we're going from a majority white to a minority white on the island. But something has happened, and has happened very quickly. We have gone from the politics of passion, or what I call, to the politics of reason. We at the University of Miami conducted a poll, like my colleagues at FIU, during the presidential election of 2,500 Cuban-American registered voters. And we asked them, who would you vote for? Well, you know, 70% of Cuban-Americans, as you know, are registered Republicans, traditionally. McCain got the lowest percentage of any Republican candidate since Cubans arrived in South Florida. It's still pretty high, 63%. But the interesting point, when we asked them, what were the issues that determined who you voted for? In this order, the economy first, 44%, followed by the war in Iraq, health care costs, education, oh yeah, and Cuba last. 4.2% said that they made up their mind on who to vote for based on Cuba. We ran the statistics three times because we couldn't believe it. 4.2%. There is a change. You can now go to Versailles on A Street and interview all three generations of Cubans, and they're beginning to say, you know, this administration might be looking at issues that maybe we should have been looking a long time ago. But this administration also needs to be very cautious, and I believe they are. Because if my memory doesn't fail me, Peter, this is the 11th president, that Fidel and Raul have been dealing with. So it remains to be seen. There's a great book, and I invite you to pick up a copy of it if you haven't read it, by Ian Bremmer, called The J-Curve, which applies to governments and change, particularly economic. But the issue here that we need to be aware and concerns us a great deal, the centralized governments are usually pretty stable. And then when you open up the system, you have this big dip of instability that a lot of the times the system itself is not prepared to deal with. And that in itself can create a tremendous internal strife. Why I bring that up is because, you know, we, particularly here in D.C., always worry about the neighbor to the south, Hugo Chavez, if he was going to come to the rescue, which I don't think, and maybe that's why Perez Roque now is painting with Robaina and no longer Minister of Foreign Affairs, when he came back from the United Nations and said that the Cuban government was ready to give its flag and sovereignty to Hugo Chavez. Under no circumstances. The FARC remained not only loyal to Raul Castro, but highly nationalistic. So in conclusion, just for you to think about, I do believe the systems in transition or change are typically characterized by the coexistence of the old and new structures, values, and attitudes. I just don't think you can go from one to the other overnight. They both have to. There's a process, if you will. The emergence of a new state may have a few common elements of the old order. And in the case of Cuba, that old order is Raul Castro. The greater the disparity in between the old and the new states, the more difficult that transition process will be for its citizens. And that's the word, citizens, the Cuban people, not the apparatus of the institutions to a great extent. And finally, as the old state begins to transform, the human needs of its citizens, such as some of the issues that I mentioned, may remain unmet. And that is, could create that social instability that I think we talked about in particularly. The process of transformation of values and attitude is not one-dimensional, but rather affected by multiple factors simultaneously. And in this particular case, race is a big factor that we forget about. And the dissident and opposition motives for pursuing change may be other than the creation of a democratic state. The absence of democratic institutions cannot be created overnight. It will take time. It will take time. So let me leave you with those thoughts, and I'll be happy to answer any questions. Here's my email and the Institute's website, which I do invite you to visit if you haven't done so. And I look forward to the Q&A period.
Thanks, Andy. Dr. Blanco?
Cubans so reluctant to the Caribbean Basin Initiative, which, as every good American, he would call CBI. And I say because CBI in Spanish reads like conflicto de baja intensidad. and people get a different impression of the intentions of that policy and of what is behind it. I had a bad experience in Cuba when I drop out of government, and I try to, you know, push for more openings in Cuban society by building up institutions even within the framework of the Constitution and the legal framework that exists in Cuba. And the liberal establishment here came up with a notion of Track 2 policy. The Track 2 policy, which was meant to be a people-to-people policy, and I wanted to take as transferring the challenge of the bilateral relation from a conflictive relation, from a confrontational, and perhaps with danger of violent escalation relation, to a challenge in the area of ideas, of culture, of institutions. But that was not the translation in Havana, and certainly the debates in Washington did not help, because at that time, the Helms-Burton legislation was also being promoted, and the arguments that were used against the Helms-Burton legislation was, hey, you know what? We have a real weapon here. It's much better than the Helms-Burton legislation to get Castro. And we can use this as a cover-up for intelligence recruitment, influencing people in Cuba, and so on and so forth. That obviously did not put everyone of us in Cuba under good light. And it did not put the words of civil society and the notion of building up a more open civil society in Cuba on the good light. One problem also about getting lost in translation, of course, is that civil society, even in academic theory, has a lot of different interpretations. So I am going to ask for your benign cooperation for the next 10 minutes and simply follow me with this operational definition. I don't care if you believe in it or not, just, you know, take it for granted. Just take my definition for the next 10 minutes so that you can at least understand where I'm coming from. And then you can decide if this is sound or not. I would say that civil society is basically a conglomerate of a multitude of associations, free associations of citizens, individuals, motivated by an incredible infinite array of goals and inspirational themes. And those institutions and those associations are also, in many ways, the vehicle for citizen continuous participation in public life beyond the regular electoral elections for governmental representatives. So if there is one concept that is crucial for the liberal rhetoric about liberal democracy in terms of citizen participating and citizens selecting freely their representatives and so on, that is civil society. But if you come to a socialist, not very hardline rhetoric in terms that socialism should be the expression of the continuous and direct involvement and engagement of the citizens in public affairs, then civil society should not be taken as subversive. It should be taken, if you mean what you say, it should be taken as part of the construction of socialism. The problem is that for having a civil society being able to carry out those functions, you have to have an enabling environment for the citizens. You have to have an enabling environment for the people to really exert its function as the genuine... I'm sorry about that.
That's probably Raul Castro.
I was told that this was not operational right here in Washington. I didn't care for turning it off. Jesus, where I have it? Here. Okay, I got it. Sorry.
Choice of music, though.
Yes, I prefer it to salsa, believe me. Okay, done. If we're going to take Raul's words seriously, and we're going to say, yes, anything that the United States or any other country, for that matter, should discuss with Cuba should be based on the full respect for Cuban independence, sovereignty, and self-determination. I don't have a problem with that definition at all. I have always believed in that definition. My problem is that for the Cuban people, for the Cuban nation, to exert its free self-determination, it needs an enabling environment to do so. It needs a certain number of rules, legal, basic freedoms that they could use to express what their real will is, what their real choices are. They need to have the possibility of choosing between different ideas, between different options. They have the need to express what kind of system, even if it's not liked by the others, they want to give to themselves. But for us to be sure that that's what they want, we would like to see an enabling environment for the sovereign, which is the people, to exert those rights, to freely exert those rights. And the problem with the Cuban context, legally speaking, is that it's a disabling environment for exerting the free right to sovereignty and to self-determination. It's difficult to ascertain, forget about a poll, it's difficult to ascertain exactly what kind of choices would people like to see, except in those rare circumstances where every 5 years or every 10 years, depending on the critical situation in Cuba, the government decides to open up a little bit and say, okay, don't be scared. Jesus, why they have to be? Don't be scared. That's the phrase used by Raul Castro to invite for the discussion. Talk your minds. Well, I don't see why the advice that they should not be scared if that's allegedly not necessary. But it is. Unfortunately, it is. And people came up with a number of things that they would like to see. They want to freely travel back and forth. They want their relatives outside to do the same. They want all Cubans to be able to move freely inside and outside of the island. They want free access to information. And given the fact that the government has been repeating for so many years, 5 decades by now, that they would like to give more choices of information to the Cuban people, but the problem is that they don't have enough paper and ink. Well, guess what? Instead of, you know, building up a new TV station or putting up a new newspaper, just simply do not prosecute legally those that have an antenna to watch satellite TV. Do not chase around the people that want to get some access to the Internet. Provide those facilities to the population instead of controlling them every time more and more. People want to have better housing and better food and all the rest, but most of all, they want to exercise, and mostly the younger generation, they want to exercise a basic right, and that is the right to dream for their own better future. And the drama of Cuba is that more and more young people arrive to the conclusion that their right to dream for a better future has been confiscated the way that before properties were confiscated from the bourgeoisie, etc., because the system does not provide you with a reasonable environment to say, I am not going to be depending on what Raul could do for me. I'm not going to be depending on the embargo being lifted tomorrow. I am going to depend on myself. And that's another demand, a demand that people could have self-reliant in the economic, could be self-reliant economically and could start their own ventures and so on. The problem is that the system, the way it is, I mean, if the Cuban leadership wants to recover its popularity beyond those figures that were given in the poll, if it wants to consolidate legitimacy, if it wants to make sure that people would be happy to look for a better future inside the island instead of looking for a better future outside, then they have to change a lot. There is this wonderful novel in which the character keeps saying everything has to change so that nothing would change. And a lot would have to change if they really would like some basic things to remain the same. But the problem is that the things that have to change have to do with the pillars of a certain regime of governability, of an authoritarian, totalitarian, as you wish to call it, regime of governability. Repression, of course, is one of them, but that is not the most relevant one. I am a person that firmly believes, and that is why I enjoy the previous presentation so much, in the power of perceptions. People do not act, and nations do not act according to reality. They act according to their perception of reality. And so their perception of reality becomes part of reality because it transforms reality. And one important element in keeping law and order in Cuba is not repression, is controlling perceptions. And those perceptions are controlled by monopolizing information, by monopolizing the freedom of movement, by monopolizing the economy so that people would have to depend on the state for getting a job and they cannot prosper on their own, and of course monopolizing the right to associate with other citizens. Only those that are authorized by the government could associate with other citizens, and those that have tried, like myself, who really believed in this in the 1990s, are under very close scrutiny and monitoring. And of course, if you step one step beyond the unsettled boundaries that keep changing at a particular moment, you might get into a lot of trouble. Now, one reason if anybody's curious, I'm a person that has always been and remain against the embargo. But one reason is because those that, or some of those that honestly believe in the embargo, they have supported the embargo believing that the embargo would have an impact on the perceptions of the Cuban people in the sense that they would have to face a lot of hardship, and because of that, they would say, well, you know, we have to work it out, we have to change this government. Well, guess what? It worked the other way around. For a long, long time, the embargo reinforced the perception that the reason to all the hardships in daily life was due to the policy of the embargo. But another reason why I am not very cautious about the embargo is because it's not really a policy. It's a tool. It's a tool of a policy or of two policies with two different doctrines in the 1960s and then in the 1970s and 80s. It was a tool for rollback of the Cuban Revolution. And then it became a tool for containing the Soviets. At one point, the American establishment came to the conclusion that Fidel was an incredible bad economist and an incredible bad manager, and it was great to bleed the Soviet Union with resources by obliging Cuba to depend on the Soviet Union and obliging Castro to go back and forth asking for more and more resources that he would throw out the window. But it's a tool. It's not a comprehensive policy. It's a tool that was born for a world that was bipolar and marked by the Cold War. It was not, at that time, there was not a global economy, interdependent, and a multipolar world. So when I see all the time these passionate debates, Andy was talking about passion in Cuban politics, there's passion around here in Washington sometimes too, on the embargo, and people saying, should the United States change the policy towards Cuba? I would say refine that and ask yourself, should the United States have a Cuba policy towards Cuba? Because the embargo is not. And then once that you have decided what policy you want, based on what foreign affairs doctrine, on what principles to chase certain goals, you can decide if the embargo, as it is, or with modifications, may or may not be a part of a toolkit of that new policy. Going back to perceptions, there has been, maybe there were more, but I distinctly see three moments in which the monopoly on perceptions that the Cuban government exercises over the population was shaken, badly shaken. One was in 1979, 1980, when the Cubans were authorized to reestablish relations with their relatives abroad, not only in the United States or anywhere. Up to that moment, if your uncle has left the island or your father has left the island, you could not write to him, you could not receive letters from him, you cannot call him on the phone, and of course he cannot visit you and you cannot visit them. But after 1978, after the dialogue of 1978 in Havana, and after the release of more than 3,000 prisoners, now there is about 200-something, the possibility of normalizing relations between relatives became real. And when all these Cubans arrived to Cuba, the perception of the enemy was diluted. These were not the enemies. These were normal people. The uncle of so-and-so that lives around the corner, that cares for the family, that brought medicines even for the neighbors, the aunt of somebody else's that is so nice and worked so hard in Miami to reestablish herself in that society. I mean, all that changed the perception of the enemy and melted the kind of animosities that were built up in the Cuban propaganda for so many years. And that shook up the Cuban perceptions, as many of these people also arrived with many bags, probably bought in a discount store, but with goods that were not available in Cuba, and they spread those little presents around. The impact of normalizing relations with the relatives was the Mariel boat lift in 1980. And the impact of the Mariel boat lift in 1980 was that the Cuban government decided to open up the economy a little bit and decided to change the priorities from investment in development to consumer goods for the next 5 years, because they couldn't overlook the fact that so many people that were not anymore the bourgeoisie, not even the middle class, but rank and file poor people wanted to leave the country from all races, from all genders, from all ages. A second time that the perceptions were badly shaken were, of course, after the fall of the Berlin Wall and the Soviet Union. And it was not only because there was an economic crisis that followed, because the main market and the main supporter of Cuba disappeared. It was also because for the first time, the Cubans realized that all those millions of nice, disciplined citizens that paraded in Red Square and paraded in cities in Germany to celebrate socialism were the very ones that rejected socialism. And they also realized in the 1990s that the very people that went to support in the last electoral parade, the Sandinistas, were the ones that voted them out of power. And they realized that their government was riddled with corruption and engaged in drug trafficking, and that their government extended impunity to people that sank a tugboat with children and women inside in a criminal mass murder. So all that came together. And again, perceptions were shaken. And the government had to do something about it. And there was probably the most significant opening in Cuban society that ever happened before, from 1993 to 1996. By 1996, Fidel looked around and didn't like what he saw. One of the things he saw he didn't like was that there was a new kind of dissent that was explicitly emerging. And it was not this time from anti-communist. It was from the communist, including this one who's speaking here. For the first time, people who have loyally supported the revolution, who have almost blindly believed in him, were saying, this system doesn't work. And now that the Soviet Union is not there, there is no rationale for being married to a system that we copied and imported from the Soviet Union. And we need to go back to the roots, the libertarian roots of the revolution that triumphed in 1959. And we need to consolidate the accomplishments, the social accomplishments that we may have achieved in these years, but we also have to open up to more empowerment of citizens, more empowerment of social institutions. And that claim was not coming from a small group of dissidents in some lost province. It was coming from inside party and state control institutions. And it was being published in magazines, and it was being aired in programs. At the same time that that was happening, there was, for the first time, the possibility, since the Jimmy Carter years, of another thaw in U.S.-Cuba relations. It was clear at that time that the Helms-Burton legislation did not have enough votes to be adopted. And it was also clear that Clinton's intentions in a second administration were to try to explore again, to resume again the exploration of a possible bilateral normalization of relations. Fidel didn't like that. So he decided to turn the table, and he shut down two airplanes in an electoral year in the United States, killing three American citizens and one resident. He knew Clinton had to react to that. Clinton lost an election in Arkansas due to the uprising of the Cubans who were imprisoned in that state. He was not going to go through that twice, and he had learned a lesson from Jimmy Carter and the Mariel. By doing that, he provoked, he invited for the Helms-Burton legislation to be passed, and then he used the Helms-Burton legislation to rally everybody around the flag and say, hey, you see, we are back to square one. We are here in confrontation times. So everybody has to be disciplined, shut up, and follow a party line. And these centers that were out of line were intervened. They were purged of their best and brightest, and many of the new regulations were passed. There were new laws called the gag laws. Dissidents, traditional dissidents, anti-communist dissidents thought that these were made for them. No, they were not made for them. They were made for us, for communist dissidents. For the anti-communist dissidents, they already had a lot of legal legislation in place that they could use at any time at whim. But they needed some new kind of laws that would be ambiguous enough and that they could apply to all of us whenever they wanted. The funny thing is, and here now you can go to the screen, is that in this, you have two blocks here. These two black blocks represent the Cuban people. I'm not going to call it Cuban civil society because obviously it's not free to fall under that categorization, and Cuban diaspora, not only in the United States, but all over the world. You have a fraction of the Cuban diaspora, given the changes, the demographic changes in diaspora that Andy was telling us about, that remains active, vocal, visible, organized, and old, becoming older and older. And you have an organized opposition that is becoming younger and younger, and blacker in Cuba. But the problem is, of course, that the relationship between the organized exile and the Cuban diaspora is suffering from a communication, lack of contact. When the older you get, when the older generation try to speak to the younger arrivals, they don't speak in their terms. They don't share their cultural values. They don't know what they went through. They use their own language. And most of the time, they end up offending them in many ways. While the younger generations end up offending the older ones because they don't respect them, They don't know their sacrifices before, and they don't know what they went through. So we have a generational communicational problem here in this area. Over here, of course, you can say that the repression prevents the organized opposition from contacting most of the Cuban people, except for, and that's the way they want it. They don't care about having a few thousand organized opposition elements if they make sure that they don't jump the fence and get in contact with the other rest of the population. That is why the Varela project for them was an earthquake, because they were breaking the rules. They were not meeting in a house to discuss democratic values. They were knocking at doors and getting signatures. And that was a new beginning for the opposition groups. The problem here is also a problem of language many times. The Cuban people are very keen on the kind of social demands I mentioned before. Free information, freedom of travel, freedom to start an enterprise. And most of opposition groups speak as political parties. They speak the language of democracy, elections, human rights, and that language not always connect with social demands. This is nothing new. If you look into any other country in the world, you have political parties and civil societies that speak that kind of language, and you have social movements that gather people around one particular topic and try to mobilize the public opinion around that. Well, the problem is, and here we are at the third major earthquake in perceptions, is since 2006 and since the election in the United States last year. This is since Raul took over and Obama took over in Washington. And the interesting thing here is that the information that I get from every possible source is that most people right now don't blame the embargo as the main cause of their hardships in Cuba. They blame the system, the rigidity of the system that prevents them from improving their lot. And while at the beginning there was a lot of high expectations on Raul Castro, those expectations have been lowering. And interestingly enough, for the first time in 50 years, expectations are on Obama. Can Obama do something, whatever, to try to help us out of this predicament? Now, that is not good for the Cuban government. They would have to address this situation. Let me go to conclusions, because I think that I am extending or overextending myself, I'm afraid. One, I would say that the U.S. could perfectly well define a U.S. policy towards Cuba, that the U.S. policy towards Cuba, in my opinion, should be multi-track, meaning people to people on the one hand, government to government on the other, and multilateral organizations and Cuba as another track. That it should be based clearly on the respect of the Cuban nation to self-determination, independence, and sovereignty. And that the initiatives and actions that could be taken within that context should be consistent and respectful of international law, should not violate the norms of international law. And that the discussions over here to adopt such a policy should never, ever, again, use it as, you know, as or say that is the best possible weapon to change reality in Cuba. That's all. Thank you. I apologize.
Thank you very much, Juan Antonio. I'm sure there are plenty of questions from the audience. I'm going to first invite the panel if they have any responses they'd like to make to any of the points that their colleagues had made, and then we'll open it up to discussion. Go to questions. Ladies, if you would please state your name and your affiliation when you ask your question, and please make it a question. Thank you very much. Miss.
Thank you. Kimberly Finch, Department of Defense. Dr. Blanco, I wanted to ask just a quick question for clarification. The people you referred to who no longer blame the embargo for their issues, are you referring to Cubans on the island or Miami Cubans or Disapora or everybody? Pardon? On the island? Okay. And I also had another question just for the entire panel. No one really delved deeply into the reforms proposed and passed by under the Obama administration. I wanted to know sort of what the perception was in Havana for the in Miami of the changes, and if there's a huge divide between generations of the perceptions of these changes.
I've been even surprised at the reaction in Miami. And I don't know how you feel about it. It's been very welcoming to a great extent, even by the older generation, understanding, you know, my argument has always been that U.S. policy towards Cuba has been domestic. It has been to appease the Cuban-American community in Miami. And something happened during this presidential campaign. As all the candidates came through, they realized that finishing their speech by saying Viva Cuba Libre was not enough. Then now you had Cuban-Americans in the audience asking them about what were their plans for the war in Iraq, how were you going to deal with the economy, and it really caught them off guard. So the Obama administration engagement, if you will, constructive engagement, and not only that, but taking the conditions off the table, I think has been fairly welcome in Miami. There's still those that have some question about it to a great extent, but I think it's been very, very much welcome in Miami.
I agree completely. I think that obviously there's still a small minority, I think we can call it, to conservative minority who oppose even the lifting of travel and remittance restrictions. But the majority of Cubans and Cuban Americans, I think after 50 years of a failed policy, realize that this is something that might be worth, you know, once again implementing and having contact, having money flow onto the island and perhaps change things that way partly. The other thing is that the community in Miami or South Florida has demographically and changed completely over the last few years. There's been a lot more people coming from the island. And this is important because obviously these different waves of migrants have had different experiences. Mm-hmm. And the people who've come in the last 10 to 15 years are full-fledged products of the revolution. And they mainly still have family on the island who they want to support and who they want to see. So that growing group of people who, however, cannot vote yet, and this is interesting,
exactly.
They're not a voting body yet. So I'm sure when they become nationalized and they can voice their opinions in the vote, we'll see a lot of changes there too towards a U.S.-Cuba policy. But they are a silent group. But they are the ones who are being interviewed by the journalists. And so you hear those kinds of voices growing. And obviously there's also a large group of second and third generation Cuban Americans who are just, frankly, curious. They want to understand and get to know this country their parents or grandparents are from. They've often been educated outside of Miami or Florida, often have, a more open-minded view towards not only Cuba but things in general. So I think those factors play into why some of those attitudes are changing in South Florida and why these restrictions, lifting of restrictions, have been pretty much welcomed. And last but not least, as I'm sure you all know, family matters not only for Cubans but Latinos in general in terms of being able to reach out, send money, and go visit. And I think Andy and Juan Antonio will agree that even many of the Cubans and Cuban Americans who said they didn't send money before actually did,
yeah.
Particularly those that had family, because family matters.
Yeah.
So now people can say they do and be more honest and transparent about it. And so I think those are some of the main factors.
My name is Gary Bohigian. I'm with State Department. And this question is directed to all of the panelists, as they would like to respond. Could you identify further and discuss any known indicators of discontent within the political elite? And that would include sectors that are near the political elite, like family relations or lower-level officials who by themselves wouldn't qualify as being within the elite.
Why don't you go first?
I was over on your side of the world yesterday and also at DOD addressing some of the same issues with some of your colleagues. You know, if there has been one and one very good institution in Cuba, has been the FARC, the military. And the military up to now has been controlling between 60-65% of the economy, the Cuban economy. So, I mean, these guys are not only well-trained military of officers, but a lot of them have their MBAs from very fine institutions behind the Soviet Unions and others. Now, once Fidel totally disappears from the picture, the question that I ask myself and some of my colleagues and some of your own colleagues in those two American agencies is, that military that up to now has not participated in the corruption of the economy or all the fruits of that corruption, I think they're going to ask the question, if I am to remain loyal, what am I going to do? What are you going to do for me? I still have to put food on the table. Now, let me be very clear. I and my colleagues that look at this stuff don't see, I'm not saying that we see a coup anytime near whatsoever. But you're beginning to see Raul Castro, and he recently changed the three top generals of the three armies, which have been Fidelistas, particularly, with more of his people, and they're younger. As a matter of fact, one of them is Afro-Cuban, excuse me. So if I see that there could be a possibility of a break, it will be down the line within the Cuban military. The Cuban military has never been called to put down an unrest in Cuba. It has always been the forces of the Ministry of the Interior. So that will remain a question. If there was going to be a social unrest, what role would the Cuban military would play?
I basically agree with my colleague. Let me put it this way. There are two problems here. One is once that not only Fidel but also Raul is absent, who is going to accept in that country the leadership of Machado and Tura? Everybody takes him as a joke and as a bad one. I mean, to tell a general to accept the leadership of Machado and Tura in that country, I mean, they are accepting it because it's Raul's choice. But once that Raul is gone, there is a major problem here of transition. Who's going to be the next person? And the other thing I can tell you, because I was a witness and direct, I had conversations with some of the people that recently were removed, like Laje, José Luis Rodríguez. It is hard to find anyone, and I would even bet Raúl Castro himself, that would believe in the system as it is today.
Good point.
So if we're talking about a discontent with the way that things are, that includes almost everybody. Now, there may be disagreements on how to fix it and how far can you go in reforms or what kind of reforms. But I have never, particularly in my last years in Cuba, I left in 97, and I know that it has got worse, not better. I have never found anybody who say everything was great. And there's nothing that we really have to fix here.
I have a question myself. Everyone spoke about the youth, especially the people born since the end of the Soviet predominance in Cuba. How aware is the government of the growing alienation, if that's the case, of this group of people? What is the government doing? What kind of mechanisms does the government use to reach out to young people? And at the same time, what are the other mechanisms in society that the young people gravitate towards? One would think that the government would be very concerned about incorporating this element into a national vision.
That's a very, very good question. I mean, frankly, you know, who knows what the government really thinks? It's very, very difficult to speak with any sense of real understanding of what goes on in that inner circle. We can only hypothesize. I'd like to start out just by saying that when we talk about Cuban youth and we talk about this large group of people, over 50% of the population, I'd like to talk about that group in form of two generations, and I think that's really important. Basically, those who are under 30, and thus were born before the special period, were often born or at least socialized in the so-called golden age of the revolution in the 80s, where the Soviet Union was still subsidizing Cuba heavily. Cuba's economy was, relatively speaking, fairly, you know, good for their own standards. And I grew up in Cuba at that time, and I can talk from personal experience. You know, basically everything, the basics existed. Education was pretty high quality. Healthcare was pretty high quality. Transport functioned. There were no luxury items, but you know, people had the basics. Then came the crisis. And there was nothing to eat, nothing worked. There were blackouts all the time for many, many years. And so depending on what time you came up as a youth, this 80s versus the 90s really marks you and marks your outlook and your ambitions and your personality and your values. So people of my generation are I would say, much more ambitious. We are products of a fairly decent education. We are concerned with even still political issues, although I would say that most young Cubans don't believe in anything or anybody when it comes to politics. But people who were born, say, in the 70s or came up in the 80s still have an interest and a hope that things will develop and ameliorate both on the island and elsewhere. Well, it's the generation that came up in the 90s and who are now teenagers, say, and there are of course many exceptions to the rule, but generally speaking, these are kids who first and foremost think of themselves, who are extremely materialistic, mm-hmm. and this comes out of a you know, a long period of having nothing. So this is a very typical reaction. Not interested at all in politics, are totally apathetic towards the political system, are very individualistic. They think mainly of themselves. And if you grow up in a society where you know it's you're going to make a better living becoming a concierge at a hotel or a taxi driver or, you know, black marketeering, then if you study and become a doctor or a professor or an engineer, that skews your outlook in terms of your own ambitions. Now, what has happened is that as a result, there's been a massive brain drain, particularly with regards to my generation, people who were born in the 70s and came up in the 80s. Most Cubans who are 30 plus minus. If they haven't, they're trying to leave. Because they have no opportunities on the island. They're going everywhere. I mean, from you know, the U.S. to Canada to Latin America. You know, I even have people I went to school with who are now in Malawi, of all places. I mean, it's anywhere they can go, they'll go. And the Cuban government, I think, is very, very aware of this problem. It doesn't really suit them because they're losing one of the greatest assets they have, which is their human capital. So they are trying to advise a number or construct a number of things to keep people there. One is that a lot of you know, more Cubans, young Cubans in particular, professionals are can now go abroad to work. You know, particularly as doctors, as we know, to Venezuela, but also elsewhere. But they're not just doctors. They're engineers, they're teachers, they're agricultural experts, you name it. And part of the pull factor in doing that is that you can keep part of your salary in hard currency and obviously leave Cuba and see something else of the world, etc. So this is something that's become very attractive to many, many people. The other thing is that, as you probably or some of you might know, the Cuban government has made it easier for people who get a contract to work abroad as an artist, as a professional, as a sports trainer, you name it, to keep their residency in Cuba. So this kind of decision of leaving the island for good, like, you know, most Cubans have had to do in the past, is not the only option anymore. And so that lifts a lot of people's, gives people choices, basically. So they leave for a couple of years, then they get residency somewhere else, and they come and go. And you see this happening all over now. There are many, many Cubans now who live somewhere else in Spain, in Mexico, in Venezuela. I even know some in the U.S. who come and go, literally, who have residency here and there, and it's legal. And the Cuban government has facilitated this process. It's still a bureaucratic nightmare, but it's legal and doable. And more people are seeking that out because that way they can keep their homes in Cuba, they can keep their family contacts, and it's, you know, it's their home. People want it. Most Cubans don't want to leave the island. They never have. So this is something the Cuban government, I think, has done on purpose. To not lose its human capital, to have people come back with money and have that money flow in the local economy, and also, you know, keep the image of Cubans, you know, particularly well-known Cubans, whether they're artists or sports people or academics, connected to the island and not as part of the diaspora or exile community. Nevertheless, I'm coming to a close. I know I'm dominating this conversation. Is the Cuban youth, young Cubans, both people my age and those who are teenagers now, are, because of the lack of opportunities, whether they're professional, social, cultural, or entertainment, if you want, that the government provides, or rather does not provide anymore, but used to have a monopoly on, are, as I said in my more formal talk, seeking out alternative spaces and ways of basically living their life, and that has led to a lot of young people seeking out connections to different churches, not necessarily because they've suddenly become religious or very spiritually inclined, but because churches, in fact, particularly Pentecostal and Protestant, more historically Protestant churches, have seen and understood that this is a way to attract particularly young people. So there are a lot of social events, whether summer camps, movie nights, dances, you name it, that these churches offer to young Cubans, and they're very, very popular. The other thing is, as I said before, an enormous revival of youth groups. The hip-hop movement has become extremely popular in Cuba over the last 10 years. There's been an ebbing out in the last few years, but this at one point was a very, very strong social force to be reckoned with, and as a consequence, the Cuban government clamped down on it. before, and parallel to that, the rock movement. So there are a number of youth movements that are becoming very, very popular and have for a while as a source of, you know, living and interpreting and socializing in a different manner. So these are the kinds of things that are happening. And then, of course, a lot of young Cubans are very, as I said before, materialistically inclined. So there's a lot of talk and activity around, you know, black marketeering, trying to get access to hard currencies in order to buy things that, you know, most people have never even seen of or heard of, but now exist in the black market. So those are some of the things that are going on.
Thank you. Let me just add very briefly, I came up with the idea 9 months ago to try to take the temperature of Cuba's youth on the island, and we, via the internet, we were able to have a large conference between my Cuban-American students at the University of Miami and Cuban youth in Havana that had actually been expelled from the University of Havana. And I can tell you, they're coming.
Expelled for talking to you?
No, expelled before. They're coming. They're coming, like Catherine said, anywhere. I'm not sure you're aware. They're leaving. They're coming. Their goal is to come to Miami. And as a matter of fact, some of the ones that I spoke to have actually shown up in my office. So, and Raul understands this, and the human capital is actually quite important, too. But as I said, I just, you know, Raul cannot do what Fidel has done, which was, you know, a couple of times, if you can no longer support this, you know, take off. He might be the only one left on the island. But they're coming. I don't know if you're, even Gorky is in Mexico City. Hopefully the swine flu didn't get to him. But even Gorky left Cuba with his family 2 weeks ago. The rocker is in Mexico City. So any and every opportunity that Cuba's youth will have, they will leave the island, and that will present, as you said, a huge, huge human capital problem for the future of Cuba.
Hi. I'm sorry. My name is Cheyenne, and I'm from the DEA. My question is, what is the current prevalence of drug use amongst the Cuban citizens, and how do you see that changing if the embargo is lifted?
Cuba has one of the highest suicide rates in all of Latin America among the youth, and it's not fairly well done. Luis Perez at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, about a year ago, wrote a book on it to a great extent. Drug use is
also saying that it was high before the revolution.
Yeah, and it was also high before, yeah. But drug use so much is not that big of a problem, and that's been an issue that the government has tried to control to a great extent. Is it going to be used as an escape? I don't know. Has Cuba participated in drug trafficking activities with other countries? Possibly. You know, the report that just came out on, you know, the argument that we have, do we remove Cuba from the terrorist list? You know, that's another issue. But I don't see the drug problem in Cuba as big as people play it out to be, particularly among Cuban youth. Now, you come to Miami, we self-medicate all the time. All is worse. Thank you.
Yeah, I agree. There's a... I was going to say let's include alcohol in this, and I think that is a huge problem in Cuba. And the problem here is one not necessarily because people are not attracted to drugs. It's a legal problem. In the late 90s, I think it was 1998, a new law was put into place that made it... just a very, very tough law on drug use and possession of drugs. And before that, I would not say that drugs was a big problem in Cuban society because of cost, because there's not a lot of access to it. But there was some drug use before that. particularly of cocaine and marijuana. But when this law was put into place, and maybe Juan Antonio remembers, it was like Articulo 88 or something like that, and there was a massive crackdown, and if you even just had a small amount of marijuana on you, you were put into prison for a number of years. And prison conditions, as you probably all know, are not very nice in Cuba. So people really abstain from that. But the use of alcohol for recreational purposes, but also to mentally and psychologically and spiritually escape, is something that is very frequent in Cuban society. And it's fairly easily available, and it's pretty cheap. I mean, you can get rum, low quality rum at almost any bodega. And that is something that is used a lot, and people use it a lot to deal with, daily pressures. And I think that is a massive problem on the island.
Given that the president of the Bacardi Foundation is here, Havana Club is not that good. I want to go on record.
Can I just add one more thing that it sort of may be food for thought for the future, and I'm actually quite concerned about, given Cuba's geographical location in the Caribbean, in sort of in the middle of sort of one of the main drug smuggling routes of the world, the fact that there is a potential for more drug use for recreational but also other reasons, that there will at some point, when and if things politically change on the island, be a lot of people who now are in the police or in the Ministry of Interior, young men particularly, who have been trained to be very organized, to use arms. There is a real potential for some gangs on the island that might be connected to drug smuggling, etc. So just keep that on the agenda. And given the proximity also of South Florida and Mexico and Central America, this is something that I think, with the fact that so many young Cubans are disaffected and frustrated, and we look at other societies in the Caribbean and Central America, why are those youth gang cultures, how did they come up? Some of the same potential elements, dissatisfaction, economic problems, frustration, political apathy, etc. So just keep that in mind as a potential social problem.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for having come. We've run out of time. Please thank our panelists for their splendid presentation. Thanks again.